classes about practice and integral practice, and we've been talking about this for quite a while. And what is it, third or fourth week?
Yeah.
Which is as it should be, because it's just such an essential part of integral recovery. And without the practices, integral recovery is just a really groovy, basically intellectual map of the territory, which is, you know, very useful and a very good thing. But it's not the same thing as doing the hard work of recovery. It really takes both. So if you have uninformed practice, you can get lost. You know, it's just like if you're trying to you know, travel a territory without a GPS or without a map and compass, and you know, there's all kinds of things can happen. I used to be a wilderness guide. You know, you can kind of use the sun unless it's on a cloudy day, and you can use the stars unless it's, you know, there's all kinds of things that can get in the way of navigating through wilderness area if you don't have the right tools or and know how to use them. So it's just essential. And I just want to encourage everyone that what really differentiates integral recovery from any other type of recovery that I know of at this point is the practice. And, of course, using the powerful meditation tools that we have now, the brain entrainment tools that just operate in so many different ways. In other words, when I try to explain to people, you know, about what the brain entrainment technology does, it's like, you know, like the blind guys and the elephant. I mean, which piece are you going to talk about? You can talk about the snake-like trunk or the flapping, you know, wave-like ears or the rope-like tail or the tree trunk-like legs or, you know, the big wall of the side or whatever. I mean, there's just all sorts of parts of this thing, because what's really doing is really transforming the brain to function at subtly but very powerfully at higher levels of functioning. So everything that the brain does is changed. So whether you're in the cognitive field and you're learning, or you are doing things with your body, whether you're an athlete or, you know, just driving or whatever it is, or typing, you're going to find that you're noticing that you're just getting better at it. Things start coming together. And I've been working out for a long time, but my relationship to my physical exercise, strength training, changes. My relationship to cardio changes. Yoga is really influenced, because, I mean, it's about subtle energy anyway, and I really think this technology really gets the subtle energy functioning at a more powerful level. And we, with practice, we also become very consciously aware of the subtle energy. Now, I can just stop right now and just focus on my body, and I can just feel the energy. You know, like we are electricity, I think Walt Whitman might have said. So, and definitely in the emotional line, the technology is very good at helping us work through and release traumas from the past, traumas from, you know, in the last 24-hour period of your life, and also becoming much more emotionally resilient, resilient to stress. And there's a talking to a doctor born in Germany, but he lives in England now. Peter, remember his last name, Heidi? I guess it doesn't really matter. Maybe we shouldn't out him. I don't know. It's not confidential. But anyway, he's working with us to, a teacher, by the way, and he's working with us to create tracks that will help people become more emotionally resilient, because that's his specialty. And I know in my case, stress was the precipitator of my falling into these stages and waves of depression that used to afflict me so powerfully, and, you know, would keep me down for a long, long time. And I just kept falling deeper and deeper into the pit. And now, while I'm still very, you know, sensitive and emotionally, you know, just open to the world, stuff doesn't keep me down. I'm able to deeply feel what's going on, you know, and then I come back, you know. So I've noticed that with grief and different states of consciousness that have hit me, I'm just able to be, you know, present with that. And of course, the spiritual line is very impacted by this technology. And I, you know, in my own case, the first week I was using it about a decade ago, I had this really powerful spiritual opening, and you know, non-duality and all this stuff became very, very clear experientially, and I just felt my ego self was just a little spark of consciousness that was floating in a whole sea of consciousness that was my true self, my bigger self, but very, very, very personally what I was at the deepest level. And it's just like, wow. And another thing that came out of that awakening, or that insight that came from that, was that the ego is very, very real. And it's as real as a tree or a rock or a dog or an automobile or whatever. And, you know, as real as anything in the relative world. And I've, over the years, Pam and I studied transpersonal psychology, so I've been, and I was also in a very kind of cult-like group when I was a teenager. I've noticed that you have to have right relationship with the ego when you're on the spiritual path, or you will fall into all kinds of problems. So I noticed among my Zinni friends and especially in the West. I mean, I haven't studied them in Japan or someplace in the East, but as far as the United States, every time you have a spiritual system that denies the reality of the ego seems to steal the whole show. You know, the shadow rises up and just causes. So we have to deal with that. And then and Western psychology is pretty brilliant in mapping the ego and learning about that. However, it's not enough. If you're just, all you have is your point of reference is the human ego, you're like a duck chasing its tail. You just go round and round and you never remember. You also need the transcendent states of experience and moves into a stage awareness. I mean, it begins to stabilize. So you have the skillful work on the ego and its foibles and healing that and releasing. Working through our old, you know, our old conditionings, whether they're cultural, ancestral, DNA, past life, God knows, there's a lot of stuff. And working with that so that you can actually become a vehicle that is ready and healthy enough to be able to channel and work with these higher energies without you becoming weird, you know, and starting to, you know, to abuse this this understanding. So every time you have a guru who's coming up who may be a great charismatic, even realized spiritual teacher, if they haven't done their own ego work, their own shadow work, you're almost always going to have it ending in disaster. He or she dishonors their work, themselves, their community. That's a story often told, as the bard said, over and over. So we really need to do both of that. And does this technology help us do the profound egoic level work, but it also helps us to really begin to experience the transcendent states of being more and more often. And you know, when you say ego work and spiritual, me, I don't even know where the line is anymore, because it's all God. You know, it's all same. All sort of the same thing. And as Nargarjuna has said, the 5th century Buddhist sage and scholar, whom many refer to as the second Buddha, he was that powerful in his influence. He said that emptiness is form and form is emptiness. And in other words, the relative world is none other than emptiness in form. And form is none other than
emptiness and form again. So it's all the same thing. If you could see with the eyes of spirit, I think Ken called it, or the eyes of contemplation. So those are some of the things that we gain in the spiritual realm. And when that happens, of course, then other issues in our lives, such as addiction or depression and everything, we can see their proper place in face of the infinite, which ain't much. And when we begin to experience ourselves as that, it really opens us up in a way that these old conditionings and these disorders, whether they're psychological or biological, and again, I have a hard time differentiating which is which, because they're all part of the same field, and they can begin to open up and release and heal. And the good thing is that our brains and our bodies and our spirits do want to heal. We're moving towards higher levels of integration and health and capacity. So if we learn to, not like we have to manufacture that, but if we learn to practice and work with that, then that really opens up a whole new world that we hadn't even dreamed of. What we're able to become, what we're able to do, and we start remembering who and what we are. But all of these really have to be integrally informed, and that was the puzzlement, for centuries, that why, were these people that were the best and the brightest in so many fields acting out so terribly? Well, because they had certain lines of development that were really high, but other lines of development, other intelligences, were not being developed. So we have to cover a essential basis. And again, this has to get off the drawing board and off the theoretical board and actually be part of our lives. And so we have to cover, we talk about the four basic lines we have to work, is the physical health, right? Exercise, strength training, cardio, yoga, good food, supplements, etc. Clean water, all of the stuff that the human body needs to thrive. We have to grow intellectually, learn, because ideas can be very, very transformative. And we are so much the result or the product of what we feed our brains. So if you're just feeding yourself junk food and just junk and watching Entertainment Tonight on a continuous loop or whatever, there's so much junk, out there right now to consume. However, there's also unbelievable transformative breakthroughs in science, wisdom. The ancient wisdom traditions are all available to us now. The esoteric stuff that was all hidden except for the elite few is now available to everyone. There's just so much going on to be learned, and we have to kind of use our own inner sense of discrimination and guidance to know what to study, because it keeps coming up. And I had this book keep coming up. Heidi, what's the book you're reading? Meditation.
Oh, wait. Ah! Wait.
I'm waiting. The Untethered Soul.
Can you hear me? Yeah. I'm muted.
Yeah, so anyway, that book has come up several times in the last day for me. So it's one of those synchronicities of saying, okay, John, you should probably read this. So, we have to pay attention to all the necessary parts, which is the body, the mind, of course, the emotional health, which is what we're talking about in the shadow work and the resilience and learning and state training, where we learn that states are just things that come and go like clouds in the sky. And, we can work with them skillfully, but we can't be, deceived by them or attached to them or repelled by them, because they're just temporary states. And anything other than just allowing them to be there and expanding our awareness to that, in meditation, where we become the spaciousness more and more, you slip in and out of this, but more and more, the spacious that all these things arise in. And then we stop becoming the slaves of states. We stop, doing everything that, spending our life chasing these phantasms that don't actually produce authentic happiness or authentic wisdom or liberation or enlightenment or anything like that. So to learn states and to learn stages is very important, because you will interpret your states from whatever stage of development you're currently at, just as you will interpret everything. And my good friend Rolly Stanich, who is a great guy and kind of a big, you know, one of the early movers and shakers in the integral Christian unfoldment, said that we see God through colored glasses, which is a great, you know, referring to spiral dynamics and Ken's colors of the stages. In other words, you will understand that idea of divinity, whatever that God thing is, from whatever level you're at, with the tools you have available at whatever current stage of development you are. So if you're at blue, you certainly won't be experiencing God through green glasses. It'll be blue glasses until, you know, you move to orange and green, et cetera. And thinking about integral consciousness, we get to look through at God through all of the glasses simultaneously, because that's what integral does. It integrates all the former earlier stages of development. And why is integral practice important in this thing? Because they've determined from research back in the 70s and 80s and into the 90s that as far as this stage development, that meditation was one of the only things that could reliably guarantee moving from one stage to another. And they said generally it took about 5 years of practice, meditation practice, to move from one stage to another. And I think that anecdotally we're seeing that when people are using these super meditation techniques that get you right into the party real quick without years and years and years of trying to learn to control your states, that probably can happen a lot more. And, you know, why is that important? Well, because as you move in these higher stages of development from ladder, you know, first tier, you know, world-centric, begins at orange, really gets going in a much more deeply embodied felt sense at green, then really becomes integrated at second tier and cosmocentric, et cetera, emerges. But all of the problems we're facing us as a species, and of course, and we hold, you know, hostage all the other species on this planet because of, you know, we're at the top of the food chain, and because of there's so many of us and our technologies, et cetera, that are world-centric, at least world-centric, have to be dealt with in that level. And if you go back and try to deal with them from an ethnocentric level, as we see all over the world, the Middle East, and in our country too, it's just there's no solution there. So as the man said, you have to up-level it. I think it was Einstein, to solve a problem, you can't solve a problem on the level it was created. You have to go to the next level. Anyway, so, yeah. So, boy, I've just said a whole bunch of stuff. Are there any, and trying to give the 50,000 foot altitude vision of why integral practice is essential, and it is the heart and soul of integral recovery, and for all of us, because we need more and more of us to wake up and more of us to heal and get wiser. So any questions or comments at this point?
Hi, John. It's Victoria.
Hi, Victoria.
And hi there. So what's coming up for me is the question about how the entrainment with our brains affects the rest of us. Like, you know, we hear that we have become so left-brained and intellectually oriented a society.
Mm-hmm.
And that we need to move more into a heart center, or, you know, right brain, or however you want to put it. And then there are things like heart math, for instance, that focus more specifically on the heart. So I'm just wondering how working at that level of brain affects, you've already talked about it some, but just how the whole thing works together.
Well, you know, and it's like at different levels, you know, you need to do different things. In other words, in blue level of development, say the mythic level of consciousness, yeah, it's all about heart and feeling and faith and emotions and stuff like that. And to move to orange, you have to really turn the brain on. You know, it's kind of the brain is the leading organ to get you from blue to orange. You know, when you start the old answers, the mythic stories and stuff just aren't meeting the needs of current reality. And then we move to green. It's really the heart that comes online. Okay. And, you know, orange is kind of, you know, capitalist, greedy, head focused, intellectual, in your head, blah, blah, stuff. And so the green really begins to develop the heart. So again, when you move into integral, you have to bring together the, as in heart math, the coherence of the brain and the heart, where things really get moving. Or in the case of the brain, you know, it's pretty, you know, common popular knowledge now. We have a left and right side of the brain. And one neuroscientist that I was reading said it's like we have a left and right brain. He considered two brains for the price of one, or two brains in the skull. And the right brain is associated with the intuitive, receptive, feminine type of knowing. And left brain is the more linear, more masculine, intellectual, you know, figuring things out, doing the math and you know, cooking the books and doing the numbers. And those are both essential ways of knowing when it comes to being human. And so what we want to do, and what this technology seems to do, is begins to integrate and equalize the function of left and right brains. So you can literally have your cake and eat it too. In other words, you can have your deep, artistic, spiritual, intuitive, connective side, and you can have your linear, you know, task-oriented, masculine, get-or-done side too. And so when those things come on, then you really have something that's quite beautiful. And we don't want to, at an integral level, we don't want to preference the one over the other, which is what happens at you know, largely in first tier. It's like, oh, you know, are you, you know, a tree huggers is one of the put downs that orange will say about green, you know, and of course you're just, you know, you're on a head trip, you're in your mind, blah, blah, blah. Some of the put downs that green has about orange consciousness. So what we really need to do is bring forth the best of both of those and bring them together. And that's what this technology seems to do. And as the brain is, yeah, and the brain is pushed to, you know, our brain is just incredibly dynamic. It's not just this static, you know, blob of gray mush that, you know, we start whacking our brain cells, you know, when we're young and experimenting with drugs or doing whatever we do in high school, and then it just diminishes from there. It's actually rebuilding and regenerating all the time, and it wants to do that. So if we can work with that skillfully and consciously, man, we don't know just how far this thing can get. And, of course, there's this, you know, the been in popular parlance for a long time since I was a kid. You know, we have these huge brains and we just use this little portion of them. Well, I think now, and using this type of technology, we're actually beginning to use more and more of this brain. And more is coming online. And it's as if evolution paid it forward. We didn't evolve the brains we needed at the moment. We evolved the brains that we're going to need later down the road, which is like right now. And so it's not enough just to say, yeah, we have these great brains, but we have to skillfully learn how to train them. And, of course, because it is essential to every human endeavor, when we heal the brain, when we work with it and it starts functioning at higher levels in a more integrated way, then it changes everything. It changes everything we do, from you know, shopping for groceries, to writing novels, to, you know, playing music, to making love, to, you know, you name it. It all gets shifted. And I think we begin to feel that if we do the practice, you know, dedicatedly in short order. Victoria, was that, did I answer anything that you asked?
Yeah, that was really helpful, particularly that recognition of the shift between first and second tier, and that it is the integration that begins to happen and continues at that second tier level. And this is a very powerful way to help affect that shift and that change. Yes, that was very helpful.
Terrific. Any other questions or comments?
Hi, John. It's Sally here. I'm just wondering, so when you're using the word, push, are you referring, what are you referring to? Is it brain integration?
In other words, the evolution, in other words, stress is the mother of evolution, okay? If everything is in balance and everything is working just fine, things seem to remain the same because there's no need to change. Perhaps that's what happened early on in our evolution as a species. I mean, you go back and study spiral dynamics and you go to beige and purple. I mean, these tribal cultures and everything were around for a long, long time because they found a way that, that seemed to be working. You know, they were kind of in that groove. And then you find more and more as history really starts to speed up, that the different levels of evolution begin to come online much more quickly. And because there's more humans, we're tool making beasts, right? And our technology and the numbers of us and all the, the stressors and all the conflicts and all this stuff. So you have to, move from bloody red to holy blue, and from holy blue to scientific orange, and from scientific orange into compassionate green, and these things that could come up because the prior levels were not answering it. So when you're working out any kind of practice, say you're doing you're going to gym and when you get your body strong, you push your muscles beyond their comfort zone, okay? And so there's a little bit of breakdown, and then they come back really strong. So you don't want, and you have to learn, how to do that wisely. Most of us do not push ourselves too hard. We tend to err on the lack of effort, but there are occasionally individuals that you have to, roll in, especially in the early stages. They're at the gym and they all want to just get after it. I mean, some of them are so happy just not to be screwed up on drugs and, through withdrawals. They want to, build Rome in a day, and they end up, as much as I can say, they can barely move 2 days or 3 days down the road from being so sore. So you have to, be wise about your practice. But when you push yourself into that zone, beyond your comfort zone, that is a zone which then begin to reorganize, at a higher level. So that's what I believe is happening with these deep, very powerful brainwave states, that it pushes the brain into these states where they're receiving energy in some way, a more stress, but stress in a good way. I call it in my book. In other words, positive stress that causes us to grow, and then the brain begins to reorganize, and we keep doing that, and the brain just subtly reorganizing the higher levels of functionality. So, does that answer the question?
Yeah. It answers the question. I suppose I have, obviously this is a lecture and I won't go into any personal details here. I have a disquiet, I think, about that, in that it seems to me to be very much as a developmental model rather than a sort of immanence model.
Right. Well, it's more, it's emptiness and form, okay? Immanence is emptiness. It's like Ken says that, the emptiness that the Buddha understood and unified with and taught from is the same emptiness as it is today. It doesn't get any emptier. However, on the relative side of the street, it's developmental. It's evolutionary. On that side of the street, things change all the time. From the time we're born to the time we die, we've gone through tremendous changes. And as species, we evolve. As ecosystems, we evolve. As solar systems, we evolve. Yet the change is happening all the time. But that arises from emptiness, from immanence. So you really have to understand that both of these things are there at all times, and how to work with both, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, it makes sense. I guess you're saying Rome wasn't built by Buddhists sitting in the lotus position.
Yeah, I mean, maybe
you know, I doubt that there were a lot of Buddhists building Rome. It was kind of a very not kind of very Buddhist-y culture. But, yeah, but the lotus, you know, the inner practice gives us the inspiration, the creativity, and the compassion and wisdom to deal skillfully with the relative world. And in the relative world, it's all developmental. You just can't escape it.
Mm.
You know, you look at, you know, you look at the history of evolution, and it goes back, you know, of life. It goes back several hundred million years from very, very simple unicelled organisms to, bingo, 2014. It's a lot of change. It's a lot of development. And, yeah, it's just...
But I'm not sure that's really true of meditation practice, all meditation practice.
What's not really true?
That everything is developmental. I think that can lead to, you know, a stressful meditation practice, and why so many people give up and don't want to do it because they feel they have to get somewhere.
Well, no, it's that meditation. I mean, you know, this is all paradoxical. You know, yes, it's resting in emptiness, but that very resting in emptiness is what all evolution and change comes out of itself. That's where it comes from, you know, and so you can't tease one away from the other. And I know at kind of there's some things that come out of green consciousness. While it's super, super high level of moral development anyways, compassion and care for the earth, et cetera, it's really, I get scared when you talk about hierarchies and development, because that means that something is better than something else. And they don't want to make those kind of judgments, which is, you know, true, you know, on one level, but it gets really silly on a actual practical level. You know, we have to make judgments and discernments all the time. You know, if there was a house burning down and you knew there was a baby in there and there was an ant, you wouldn't run in and try to save the ant. You would try to save the baby. I mean, you know, that you wouldn't have to think about that. That's just how, you know, we make judgments about sentience, and some things are more important than others, and some things are worse than others, which is part of being human. And to do exactly, you know, ultimately takes compassion and wisdom, which we get from the inner work.
Mm.
But I hear where you're coming from, you know, and I struggled with that myself. So just know that, you know, there is no form with emptiness, and there's no emptiness without form. It's all the same thing. But in the form side of the street, development happens all the time. And we just have to learn, you know, how to deal with that skillfully and wisely and compassionately. And that's what I believe integral consciousness or second tier is all about, is finally realizing that. And not only are we evolving, but at second tier, we actually become conscious co-participants in the process of evolution. In other words, evolution not just something that's acting on us, but we are evolution beginning to wake up to itself and evolve, you know, consciously.
This is Heidi jumping in. I just wanted to say, in my experience with the brainwave entrainment meditation, so I've been doing it probably, for almost 7 years myself, and I find that if I just sit there, it just sort of works me. I don't feel like I'm not a disciplined person. So when I meditate, my mind's generally all over the place, and I'm not trying to get anywhere. Although, you know, on inspired days, I'm inspired to dig down there and find out what's bothering me and what my shadow stuff is. But I really find it does just work. Just sitting there, you know, it just works. My stress threshold just got higher without me really doing anything. So I'm just trying to say, Sally, really, that I'm not when I meditate, I'm not trying to evolve or even, well, a little bit, but you know, I'm not really trying to get anywhere particularly, except to just feel more peaceful and content in my life generally. But I'm just trying to say, gosh, I think it does the work, just spending the time more than you, like, pushing anything.
Mm.
And the push that I get from when I first started, like the first day with iAwake stuff, well, man, the push for me was just sort of, it made me feel quite irritable. And then, cause something, yeah, that's where you get this pushy feeling, like, I don't know, something irritating. And then the next day, you know, it goes away and you feel fine. And so, but yeah, if you start new tracks and just a heavy dose too quick, then I feel pushy stuff.
Okay. Well, thank you, Heidi. That's really helpful. And thanks, John. Yeah. Thanks. That's helpful.
Okay, good. Yeah, you know, and when I sort of met, I did want to change things. I didn't want to blow my brains out from depression, you know. So I had, you know, oftentimes it's suffering that gets us into the game of transformation. And if we're totally peace and all's good, then really, yeah, you don't need to do that. You know, and Buddha said if you're just really happy in the relative world, you don't need me, you know. But if you're suffering, you know, and of course that was his great inquiry, you know, what is the nature of suffering? Why do we suffer? And, you know, the rest they say is history. That's where it all emerged from. So, yeah, suffering and stress and those are the, you know, those are the things that cause us to shift and change and evolve. And why do we want to evolve? Well, because, you know, more consciousness, there's more suffering, but there's also more delight and more beauty and more understanding too. So, you know, it's a two-edged, you know, it's complex. It's like a kid one time in a conversation we were having, he said, you know, at these higher levels of development, there's all kinds of new capacity and new awareness, and you can draw the circles of your care and concern ever larger. However, the pathologies also become more complex. You know, when you're dealing with somebody who's just kind of a red, you know, sociopath, that's, yeah, it's powerful, but it's pretty simple as far as its interior dynamics. And when you're dealing with, you know, a neurotic green or orange person, there's just more complexity. Not to mention second tier. Goodness gracious, yeah, it just gets more. Yeah, as we grow in complexity, the capacities also grow, and the beauty, the apprehension of beauty, and the creativity also grows. But also, we can find new ways to screw ourselves up. Therein is the challenge, I guess. Anything else? If not, I'll launch on to into something else. Okay, well, I'll take that as a yeah. So, you know, besides, I mean, this is pretty high, you know, level stuff we've been talking about, but it's also just practical, you know. How do you practice, and what are you going to do? You just got to do it. So you have to make sure you have, you know, if you're using this technology that the universe has evolved through us, you know, you got to have batteries, or you got to have a source of power. You have to have headphones. Hopefully you have a place to sit that's quiet enough where you can just really hunker down and center down and do the work, even if you live in a big city. And so, you know, if you live with 12 people in an apartment, you're going to have to find, you know, maybe there's a temple or a church you can go to. When I was a little hippie traveling around, in Latin America, I used to use big, enormous cities, Mexico City, Buenos Aires. I used to use churches as a place to go and pray and meditate and get away from all the activity for a while. And, you have to just make sure, do I have a place where I can, you know, work out? Do I have a place where I can do yoga? Do I have a place where I can go running? In my office here, I'm staying with my parents now because they're aging and they need my support. And they have their old, treadmill that's right next to my desk here. And it's probably about 25 years old. It's one of the original treadmills probably. But anyway, things still works. And so, I've been starting to use it in the mornings to do my cardio stuff. And I'll do 15 minutes. And they said this high intensity, high intensity interval training is the most effective thing to do. In other words, it's more effective than if you just set it at, you know, 5 miles an hour and you just run for a half hour doing that. What you want to do is, for example, I do, a minute and a half of just kind of pretty slow, 3 miles an hour, just your average walking speed for most of us. And then after a minute and a half, I crank it up to progressively. I started 7 miles an hour and then 7.1, 0.2, 0.3 through, I think, 7 or 8 cycles of that. And I also elevate so I'm like running uphill. So in 15 minutes, you know, I'm just like sweating and huffing and puffing. My heart's going and it's just a really great cardio workout. And it just, I've adapted that because I have it here. And when I go to the gym now, I can just focus on the other stuff I'm doing. I don't have to do the cardio because I have that down pretty well. So anyway, these are just, you know, the deeply practical, things to do. And I think of the last forum thing we're talking about, I was talking about just making sure if you finally realize, okay, I got to practice. I got to do this thing. And, you know, you set up make sure you have your tools, your little, you know, sacred place where you do your meditation every day, get everything ready the night before, you know, have your teapot or your coffee pot ready, whatever, in the morning to get going, and just kind of have your routine where you get up and you do your practices and gets you ready for the day. And it just, I mean, for me, it's just essential. I don't even, you know, struggle with it anymore. It's just what I do. And it's when I'm doing my meditation that, you know, I get through all my ego stuff and okay, I realize again why I'm doing what I'm doing. Sometimes we just do and do and do. We forget really the original impulse to do what we're being called to do. So we have to keep tapping back into that essence, backing into that deep soulful level, that we get to, more and more often as we practice and do the meditation, and that informs our life. And then I get my tactical information, in other words, what I'm supposed to be doing, what I'm supposed to be working on, inspirations for what I'm supposed to be writing, teaching, et cetera, comes from that deep interior work. And I just can't imagine my life anymore without an interior practice. You know, if you're just, you know, all you do is really, you know, the right hand or the quadrant, focus on that, which is pretty much what our culture has done. It gets very shallow, it gets very unsatisfying and very empty. And because we can't see through to the depth, you know, the immanence in everything. So, and then we get lost. And we get soul sicknesses, spiritual diseases. I was thinking today of the phrase compassion deficit disorder. So I think I've never heard that before, but it came to me yesterday. And without that, you know, connective and that deep compassion, which, you know, is the ultimately what we're trying to do with all this practicing and spiritual practice anyway, is to deepen our compassion, our ability to be one with, and compassion comes from the Latin to suffer with, open our hearts so that we can actually and expand our being so that we can hold it all and deal with it wisely, skillfully, and compassionately. That's what we're here to do. Questions, comments?
That's right. Yeah, just a comment. I really like what you're discussing. It resonates with a lot of things, and it's great to link to a lot of theory that you bring into it.
Yeah, and it's a, yeah. And it, you know, it's not just a burden. It becomes a delight after a while, you know. And two of the things that I focus on besides my, you know, integral practice. And that's what I want to say. The integral stuff is just foundational, and that gets you ready to do, you know, whatever else you want to focus on. And two of the things that I focus on a lot, besides all my work and stuff like that, is I'm just a passionate musician, as Heidi can tell you. And I have dedicated myself to playing blues guitar, electric blues guitar, over the last over 4 years now. And I made tremendous strides because I really understand. You know, the discipline that I developed from doing my integral practice was easily translatable into playing music. And I played guitar for, you know, since I was 13 or 14, but basically just acoustic rhythm guitar. And I've just made, you know, great, great strides. And you know, when, interesting enough, most of the people in integral recovery as far as the, you know, the teachers and whatnot, and Iowa Technology, we're all musicians. So we get together and we have these just ecstatic coming together where we play music. And it's just so deeply satisfying. You know, you really get into those flow states in music. And that's another thing about the meditation, that it puts us into and the practice, it puts us into accessible to into these flow states no matter what we're doing. So, you know, if you're a teacher or you're a writer or you're, you know, a footballer or whatever it might be, when you get into these levels of flow where you're not even consciously thinking about it anymore and you kind of know what to do, it's almost you have this capacity to see into the future and make the decisions that are just like exactly right. And it's just incredible. There's a book that I'm plowing through now called The Rise of the Superman. And that's a very dramatic title. But basically, this guy's been studying the neuroscience behind these ultimate athletes, these people that just do these incredibly dumb things, like, you know, jumping off of, you know, skyscrapers with little kite wings and, you know, free-form rock climbing, these really drastic climbs with no ropes or anything like this. And just what happens to the brain, what happens to these athletes, they just get to the place where they know what to do before they know what to do, what they're supposed to do. It's just the present and the immediate future becomes part of the same field. And it's extraordinary stuff that starts developing. And I think the brainwave entrainment, the continued use of meditation does that too. I was a few weeks ago, I think I might have shared this. I don't know if it was on the teleseminar or part of the class, but I was driving back from Texas, and I was in Colorado on this road, and I'm tooling down the road, and there's this car coming from a side road, and I said, this guy's not going to stop. I just knew it. And I was like 200 yards away, and I approached, and sure enough, as soon as I got there, he just pulled out in front of me, going, you know, like a fifth of my speed, and I knew exactly what to do, and I was just ready, and I just turned, got on the side of the road, and just, you know, went by him, and I knew it. And if I hadn't have known that, I would have probably had a really pretty devastating wreck. And the interesting thing is when it happened, after it happened, my pulse didn't go up, I wasn't, like, you know, freaked out, or, oh my God, I almost died, and blah, 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 and angry. It's just like, man, I just knew what to do, I knew it was going to happen. So those were those kind of manifestations of flow that happened. And I think, Heidi, you and I, when we write together, we often get into that state where we just, these things begin to unfold in a way that's pretty remarkable.
Yep.
So that's another thing. Performance, where performance comes at actual spiritual or a heightened level of awareness and becomes a yoga in itself, whatever you're doing, whether you're cooking a meal or cutting the grass or whatever. And that's one of the things, one of the fruits of just evolving ourselves to what we're already capable of. You know, like, why not be the most functional, most beautiful version of ourselves? And we're still all neurotic messes, by the way, but somehow both are true. You know, it's yes, 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 and yes, and.
John, this is Heidi. I wonder if you could talk just a moment about what cranial electric stimulation does that's, and you know, that's more than or different to or on top of whatever of the brainwave entrainment.
Yeah, well, that's a tool that I've been using for quite a few years, and it's really good for people who have any kind of essential neurochemical deficits going on. In other words, not enough serotonin and dopamine, these basic neurochemicals that make us capable of functioning in the world. In other words, doing all the complex motor skills that we need to just get it through the day and or feel okay and satisfied in our own skins. And of course, drug addiction completely exhausts these natural supplies, and the drugs begin to function as a pseudo-dopamine, pseudo-norepinephrine, pseudo-serotonin. And then when the drugs aren't there, you run out of drugs, there's no natural stuff, and so you feel like crap, and progressively it gets worse and worse, so you have to keep using the drugs to feel normal, not to get dope sick. So when in early recovery, people that have, you know, have had severe careers with drugs or alcohol, all the stuff is very depleted. And so there's a number of ways, tools that we can find holistically to rebuild the brain really quickly, of course, we do that with nutrition, with supplements. The brainwave entrainment works on that as well. But the cranial electrical stimulation is really good. And basically what it does, it just stimulates the growth or the release of these neurochemicals. And that just directly. And there's been a lot of who's the guy that we use in New York, Heidi?
Chip Fisher. Fisher yeah. Wallace.
Yeah, Chip Wallace is the one that I went through a bunch of different versions of this, and I think that those guys are making a really, really good version. And they've done, they sponsored a, he comes from, Chip Fisher comes from the, I don't know, there used to be the stereo company, Fisher. Stereo, I think it was his family. So he came from money, and he really put it into developing this technology. And he's shown that, I mean, with just basic traditional treatment, that he did one study where people that were using the Fisher-Wallace cranial electrical stimulator, the recidivism or the relapse rate was cut by 50%, you know, for people going through treatment, which is really remarkable and very dramatic. So I would use that in addition to the meditation and everything else we're doing. And the nice thing, you can also meditate while you have it on. And what you do is you have this little elastic headband that looks like, you know, 1970s John McEnroe tennis sweatband. And then you have these little applicators that you put where your sideburns are, the little sponges you wet, so it's the conductivity is facilitated by the water. And then you turn it on, and you feel a little pulsing, stimulating tingle where you're on the sides of your head. And if you close your eyes, you can see like a kind of a strobe light effect, you know. When your eyes are closed, you just kind of see the, you know, flashing. And it turns off by itself after 20 minutes. And you can do that in the early days. You can do it up to, two times a day, 40 minutes. And there's no, if you use it more and more, it just doesn't do anything. So there's no real potential for using it, for abusing it, or using it in ways that hurt you. And, yeah, it seems to really help facilitate the process. It's another tool in the medicine bag that we use, and people that use it while they're meditating, it seems it just helps them kind of stay. It works along with the meditation. They have oftentimes they report having maybe even deeper meditation. So anything else, Heidi? Also very good for depression, treating depression, because, again, it's a disease that is caused by our causes. I'm not sure which comes first, the chicken or the egg. But deficits in healthy neurochemical balance. And we now have tests that are available that can use saliva to show, you know, what your current state of neurochemical balance was. And in the early days, when you're doing this stuff, you have to have a spinal tap or something to do that, which is very expensive, invasive, and painful. And so mainly doctors and psychiatrists would look at you, and they could say, yeah, just by your behaviors and how you're acting and what you're reporting, that you're probably don't have enough serotonin, so let's give you this, you know, SSRI, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor type drug, and help that. But anyway, we can really blot it down now to, we can really see, and so you can give one of these tests at the beginning of treatment, halfway through, you know, at the end of treatment, or 6 months later, however that goes, so you can really look at, you know, that kind of upper right neurochemical balance.
Yeah, thanks for that, Sean. I just want to say, I thought maybe my neurochemicals were relatively normal or something, whatever normal might be. But boy, did I ever feel good when I did that. I think it's for 40 days that you do it or something at the first. And yeah. I did feel like my meditations were deeper and I was thinking clearer and better energy. I thought it was wonderful. I just wish it wasn't quite so expensive.
Yeah, so, you know, you should do what you can do. And, when we were doing our residential work, we always had a number of those devices available. So,
John, Heidi, how do you access those devices? Where do you find those?
Yeah, you can get them online. Fisher, Wallace, blah, blah. And I think I was talking to Chip not too long ago, and he says I think they're just at the stage where they're going to be FDA approved. So until then,
you needed to have a doctor, okay, in the United States.
No.
Now, Canada, Europe, and the rest of the world, doesn't matter. In fact, most of the places would just send it to you anyway. If you'd write to Canada, they'd send it to you. But, yeah, you can order it online. It's FisherWallace.com, I suppose.
Yeah, I can send out a link.
Yeah.
That'd be great, Heidi.
And their website's full of good information. It really is pretty cool stuff, I think.
And if you're like a veteran of the armed forces, they give you a 50% discount, and there may be other things where they're cheap. It's pretty expensive, but, you know, there it is. But it's definitely, when you compare it to, taking antidepressants for a year and the cost, this is really, really a bargain compared to what drugs would cost to using that to treat depression or other disorders.
Great, thanks.
Well, okay. I guess that's about a wrap, eh?
Yep.
Any other, like, just really serious, super important question that needs to be asked or a comment that needs to be made before we sign off?
Well, it just seems like each time we go deeper into the practice and how it works, and I'm really appreciating that. It's very helpful.
Yeah, and, you know, it's really vast. It's really, really vast. And Keith Richards, you know, the guitar player for the Rolling Stones, one time I saw an interview with him. He said the guitar neck is just infinite. You know, just the neck of a guitar and playing guitar, just the more you play it, the deeper it gets. And practice is the same way.
Mm-hmm.
It just gets deeper and deeper. And I try to, one thing I can do down in Texas is I can play tennis. Because, you know, in T-Sale, you can only play like 6 months out of the year because it gets so bloody cold. And so here I can do this. So I've been taking some lessons. And I just really noticed how just the dynamics of the practice. And the first two lessons, I learned, you know, different, showed me how to actually do the right, you know, backhand, forehand, and all this stuff, where before I was just doing intuitively and playing pretty good. Well, when I started, I started becoming conscious, trying to do the right thing, and my game went to hell. Pam was kicking my butt for weeks, and I was going, oh, great, you know, lesson. But I knew that I just hadn't got my, the new neural pathways weren't established, the new muscle memories weren't established, but I just kept working on it, thinking about what the right swing and what the right to do. And the last time I played Pam, I was just a lot better. And I had another lesson the other day, and I she was amazed the last time she seen me, 4 or 5 weeks ago, because I integrated what I'd learned from her in the first two lessons, and I was playing at a whole new level. And that's what practice does for us. It's really cool. It's really exciting, fun, and it's hopeful and encouraging. And it just puts a new spin on life. So instead of just, oh, you're born with your genes, and you're going to die with your genes. It's like, no. There's all these genes can be, as I write about in the book, you know, can be expressed in infinite different ways at higher levels according to how we use those many, many, almost infinite combinations that we've been given in our genetic makeup. So it's really a good story. And next life. Deeper and happier and more real and et cetera, et cetera. Well, okay, you guys.
Thanks, John.
Yeah.
Thanks, John.
All right.
Thanks,
everyone.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank
bye.
You.
See you
Friday. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.